The Amazons by Guy Cadogan Rothery, an Adult Brain production, read to you by Graham Dunlop. Chapter 1. Introductory. Never, perhaps, has the alchemy of Greek genius been more potent than in the manner of the Amazonian myth. It has bestowed a charm on the whole amazing story, which has been most prolific in its results. But, unfortunately, by tending to confine it to the narrow vistas of poetry, the intensely interesting psychological aspect has been somewhat obscured. Yet, to us, the chief value of this myth is due rather to the insight it affords into the mental workings of primitive races, the attitude of man towards that which he dreads but does not fully comprehend, than to the influence of Hellenic art and literature, fruitful in beautiful and humanizing manifestations though that influence has been. The Greek spirits, indeed, working upon a crude collection of stories, took the sting out of the lessons they should have taught. For, as we shall endeavor to show, the message of the myth to a people struggling towards a higher civilization to beware of barbarians and their ways was softened to an attitude of admiration before physical beauty and courage, and a tender pity for woman, fomenter of strife though she might be. We may unhesitatingly sweep away the story of the unnatural state about which so many Greek poets and historians entertain us. But while relegating the Amazonian state to the realms of imagination, we must recognize the Amazon herself as a not insignificant historic fact. A fact, indeed, of sufficient moment to have peopled a whole world of fiction, real enough to its original creators and whose force is hardly spent even now. Etymology will not help us much, although it has been relied upon by controversialists. Any argument founded on the descriptive nature of the word, or on its somewhat suspicious many-sidedness, must prove a double-edged weapon, as likely to injure the wielder as his opponent. Besides the obvious breastless, a mazon, and moon, maza, we are offered a choice of a variety of interpretations conveying to us such meanings as vestals, girdle bearers, and other synonyms, also game eaters and eaters of strong foods. But after all, the word is hybrid Greek, not a native name, and may be classed as a nickname, itself much younger than the supposed state. And then, naturally, it would be as comprehensively descriptive as the ingenuity of man could devise. We may, therefore, leave the etymologists to the labyrinthine twistings of their own wordy warfare. The tale begins rationally enough with a perfectly familiar incident in the life history of so many nations: the expulsion of a surplus growth of population and its emigration to new fields. In this case, we have reference to a cabal against two youthful Scythian princes, who, being ordered into exile, carry with them a whole horde of followers, men, women, and children. There is the story of their settling down, of their casting off of the old Scythian simplicity before a growing desire for riches, which leads to conquest and ultimately to their undoing, the men being mostly massacred by their enraged neighbors. Then comes the extraordinary violent rage of the widows and orphans, first against the slayers of their husbands and fathers, and later against men in general, this aversion bringing about the founding of a state that is to be manless, the women throwing aside their girdles, that priceless symbol of the unmarried, only for a brief spell in the springtime, when by commerce with their male neighbors means should be taken to guard against the extinction of the race. That such a myth should have sprung to life and gained credence is not difficult to understand. To the inhabitants of the archipelago and Magna Graecia, no matter whence they originated, distant Asia and the regions to the northeast of the Black Sea and round about the Caspian were lands of peril shrouded in mystery, out of which fierce hordes swept down bent on rapine and conquest. Beyond the fringe of the nearer Mediterranean coast, there were worlds of darkness, peopled by the fertile Greek mind with many unnatural but by no means illogically conceived monsters. For the makers of the myths had hardly emerged from the influence of animistic interpretation of nature. All phenomena were explainable in the terms of human emotions. And man acknowledged himself the relation, and not always the superior relation, of the beasts of the field, nay, even of the stocks and stones. To such men, nomadic tribes from the sandy Asian wastes bursting out of clouds of dust on their fleet horses to pillage and slaughter and then as swiftly pass away had suggested the centaur myth, the man-horses lying behind the woods ready to swoop down upon the unwary. The aborigines of forest districts, whose attacks were as dangerous and unexpected as that of the wild boar and wild goat, naturally suggested the satyrs. That yet older terror, the herds of wild buffaloes with their irresistible onrush and indomitable fierceness, had given birth to the superhumanly cunning winged man-bulls of Assyria. Successive waves of invasion rolling seaward from the northeast made utter Scythia a constant source of danger, and when the reflux waves carried the over-swollen coast population northeastward, they entered an inhospitable country where pitchy lakes and unctuous soil belched forth fire, smoke, and steam, an ominous presage of what might be expected beyond. Towering above stood a further barrier of rugged black mountains, inhabited by a race of savage warriors whose very women fought with all the ferocity of lionesses. This ever-menacing danger, with dim recollections of an outworn stage of development, when a matriarchal polity prevailed, and the nearer, more ghastly remembrance of the worship of cruel, sensual Astarte, that moon huntress goddess who came out of the Far East smeared with human gore, surrounded by her women priests, evolved in the brains of men whose thoughts were prone to take the dramatic form, the idea of a truly monstrous state, the very existence of which was a perpetual threat against humanity. Indeed, the Amazonian state, with its population of women warriors, ruled by a queen who banished all men, save a few crippled slaves, and banded together with the express purpose of making war upon mankind, perfectly symbolized the peril that Greece had to face. For the myth told not merely of war, but of unnatural war, war which, if successful, foredoomed family and civic life. It is symbolic, however we look upon it. A noteworthy fact is that certain legends made the Amazons worshippers of Artemis, while others declared them to be deadly enemies of that goddess and her followers. In art, we find Amazons wearing the crescent moon on their heads, possibly too the triple-towered crown. While their shields were either crescent-shaped or round, these, with their spears and bows and arrows, are the emblems of the moon huntress goddess, both in the guise of savage Astarte and of her Hellenized, humanized counterpart, Artemis. It would be natural for a state whose people lived on the spoils of sport and warfare, who looked upon the sacrifice of male infants as a duty, who drank out of human skulls and were suspected of cannibalism, to worship Astarte, whose early history reeked of blood and was punctuated by mutilation, a deity who symbolized a stage of society when the hunting of wild beasts was of supreme importance. The apparent conflict between the various versions of the myth no doubt arose from a confusion brought about with the lapse of time between the two aspects of this goddess. In the early forms of the legend, it would be quite in accordance with their general trend to associate the warrior women with a female deity who, at all events in the degenerate days of her cult in Asia Minor, represented lust in excelsis. And here, it is likely enough, the myth was founded on solid fact, for it is well nigh certain that the savage horde from Scythia paid homage to some prototype of Astarte. Her worship is undoubtedly of Eastern origin. This being so, one more reason would be added for the Greeks looking with mingled anxiety and abhorrence to the northeast. Among the several great cities of antiquity, which were said to have been founded by queens leading successive swarms from the great parent hive of the Amazonian state, was Ephesus. We know that its celebrated temple of Diana, Artemis, was attended by eunuch priests and probably contained statues of Amazons due to the chisels of the foremost of Grecian sculptures. Though her servants cried aloud, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," She was really a mild version of Astarte, tamed by the influence of Greek art and thought. Another significant fact is that in its earlier forms, the myths of the Amazons and Griffins are represented as implacable enemies, and even in quite late art they are jumbled up with the Wars of the Centaurs and Gigantomachia, which points to the realms of fancy. All this, of course, does not do away with the historic fact that out of those dark regions, warrior women came, now as leaders, at other times in bands, both as camp followers and in the fighting ranks. The phenomena, indeed, can hardly be said to be peculiar to any age or clime. Our own island history records the valor of Boadicea, queen of the Iceni, her sudden tempestuous appearance, leading in the slaughter of the Roman legionnaires, the sacking of Roman camps and cities, and noble in her reverses. History and art tell us that the women of Germania and Gaul fought against the Romans, and such incidents repeat themselves again and again. In 1792, the French Revolution brought forth an Amazonian brigade, and it is not without interest to note in passing that a worthy French historian had years before claim that the Franks were direct descendants of the Sarmatian Amazons. The 18th century brigade comprised the Gros Dames de la Halle and the women of the Faubourg Saint Antoine, who, their blood aflame with the lust of killing, decked themselves out with some dim thought of classic times, that heroic age which fired the thought of a whole revolutionary generation, in short petticoats, red Phrygian caps, and carried most business-like pikes. Plutarch tells us of the valiant women of Argos, who defended their city against the Spartans so well that they were allowed to dedicate a statue to Mars, and the women were thenceforth permitted to wear false beards on their nuptial day. But as regards fighting, have we not that far more piquant incident of Thalestris appearing before Alexander as he was marching through Parthia, fresh from the conquest of Persia and the defeat of the Scythians, that a queen leading an army with a legion of women warriors did come to offer homage? There is much reason to think possible, though the title Queen of the Amazons may be put down as a later embroidery of Greek historians. Plutarch, it is true, treats the whole story as a fiction and quotes Lysimachus and Alexander himself in support of this contention. Against this, we have circumstantial accounts of the invasion of Persia in the time of Cyrus by barbarians led by women. Rumors of warrior women are very persistent in further Asia, and the tradition culminates in the comic opera squadron of 150 Amazons enrolled under Ranjit Singh of Lahore. In the Caucasus, travelers reported the existence of bands of fighting women down to comparatively recent times. But they were part of the community, not representatives of a female state. The fashion spread westward, for we find Amazonian bands in Bohemia during the 8th century. And we have tales of an attempt to establish a matriarchate among those turbulent people. From Africa, we have early tales of Amazons, partly, no doubt, founded on the real existence of great queens and their women guards, but largely colored by the Greek myth. We have stories of Amazons to the southeast of Egypt, and that other land of terrors which Lady Luggard has so graphically described, a land to the south of the civilized portion, a country of the Nem-Nems, or the Lem-Lems, or the Rem-Rems, or the Dem-Dems, or the Ginem-Ginems, for the savages always bore a repeat name, and so do down to these days. And those who wrote of them invariably added, "Who eat men." Curiously enough, Greek authors refer both to the African Amazons of the East and Middle North, who are said to have overrun Asia, and also to a great Amazonian invasion coming from Ethiopia in the West. Some, indeed, would have us believe that these were descendants of the Scythian Amazons, who had wandered across the Mediterranean, passed through the Straits, and reached the Hesperides, whence they attacked Ethiopia, and marching eastward entered Egypt, crossed over to the Ionian Isles and Asia, to be finally overthrown by Hercules. It is a most curious story, this eastward invasion, with its plausible account of an alliance with Horus, son of Isis, a sun goddess, consort and successor of that primeval moon and corn god and kin, the great all-pervading Osiris, and herself identified with human sacrifice and mutilation. Now, the history of Africa north of the equator shows that there had been persistent penetrations from the east by a people of Asiatic origin, coming through Arabia and westward by Africanized Asiatics, who, finding penetration from the Mediterranean shores slow, appeared to have overrun the Atlantic coast and pushed eastward to blend with Nile infiltration. Did the fighting women come with the invaders, then truly descendants of the Amazons in the sense that these dames of spear and buckler had fought for many centuries side by side with their truculent menkind? Or did the civilized Egyptians and Berbers, advancing cautiously, ever struggling with the black bynamed eaters of men, find lands of armed maidens ready to dispute their way? If so, we have a spontaneous growth later to be exaggerated by the declamatory Greeks. Certain it is that we have early evidence of fighting bands of African women, perhaps the most famous of which are the eunuch-tended Congo and Dahomeyan royal guards. Then the less definitely authenticated matriarchal countries of women fighters on the eastward side, but no credible accounts of a woman-governed manless state. That America should possess its Amazons, not only armed cap-à-pie, but ruling over a man-free state, was inevitable. The 15th century European was dominated by the Greek spirit. He sent west not to discover a new world, but to find a shortcut to India, with its boundless wealth and all its wonders and monsters, as recorded by the ancients. Dreams of the lost Atlantis, the superb island continent, the home of the Elysian fields, which had formed in imagination a mysterious and golden bridge between Africa and India, was a constant obsession to them. It accounted so conveniently for many problems and for so many of their plausible theories. Consequently, it is quite natural that the early explorers from all countries, but more especially those who had come into closer contact with and had received an intellectual stimulus from Arabic civilization, should have seen things with a distorted vision, the result of preconceived ideas, unfailing credulity, and an abundant superstition. It is not necessary to disbelieve Francisco de Orellana's account of his meeting opposition from bands of armed women on the banks of the Maranon, and it was quite in the order of things that he should rename that river the Amazon, and straightway call forth from the vasty deep of his own credulity a state which was the exact counterpart of the Scythian Amazonia. That he and numerous other of his contemporaries had to make warfare on armed women may be accepted as fact. That they have formed corps or tribes by themselves is possible. Native tradition itself is busy with tales of great queens and women leaders. We know that there were women priests, and in certain stages of evolution, the priest is a leader and warrior. The elaborate tales of travelers who followed in the footsteps of the conquistadors, however, are suspect, both on account of their too close resemblance to Asiatic myths and because of the absence of corroboration in detail. Of the historic Amazon, little need be said for the moment. Under stress, human nature is very much today what it was yesterday and will be tomorrow. And woman, being woman, under stress is very apt to exaggerate human passions. It would be idle and tedious to labor the point which myth and history illustrate so well. On the Greek humanizing spirit, we may dwell somewhat more at length. No graven or fictile representation of an Amazon approximately coeval with even the latest true mythmonger has come down to us. All the sculptures and decorated pottery we have belong to a comparatively late date, when the original abhorrence which had conjured up the myth was passing away. Literature, however, gives us some idea of the primitive view. We are told of a turbulent, bloodthirsty race, cannibalistic, addicted to human sacrifice in their religious observances, sworn to repudiate the natural order of society, living only to make war on their neighbors, implacable in their hatreds. We see them disdaining Greek culture, rebels to the Greek demigods, overrunning Africa like demented Argonauts in search of a lying belt. For never had symbolism been more audaciously misapplied than by the Amazonian assumption of the virgin girdle, laying siege to Athens and only restraining from sacking Minerva's sacred city by the arts of diplomacy. It is a long story of rapine and robbery. Yet, even so early as the Homeric cycle of songs, the humanizing spirit was at work. Achilles, called away from his duties to the dead Patroclus to stem the Trojan onslaught, is galled into Olympic anger by the vituperative and slaughter-dealing Amazonian queen and her captains, who had come to the aid of Priam merely to vent their rage against the Greeks. But in the very moment of his triumph, when victorious, he is about to despoil the fallen queen, he is arrested by her physical beauty and, admiring her warrior prowess, is seized with remorse that his hand should have delivered the death blow to a woman. That the woman deserved her death, that she goaded Achilles to act in self-defense, does not alter the horror of the situation. For man feels himself in the wrong no matter what the provocation. The pathos of such a situation called forth the best endeavors of art. The incident was dealt with at length by Arctinus of Miletus in his poem Ethiopia, that continuation of the Iliad, which his countrymen placed so high. It is an attitude towards the Amazons that is almost invariably found in Greek art. We have representations of their warfare with the Griffins and barbarians, their defeat by Hercules, their victories and repulses before Athens. We have them in groups and as single figures, not assuredly ideal female forms, for although splendidly developed and even in the vigorous postures of hand-to-hand combat, on foot or horseback, always graceful, there is a subtle suggestion in form and mien that is not quite feminine. The faces are generally strong, beautiful in outline, often tender in expression. There is, in fact, no hint of the virago in anything that the Greek sculptors have left for us. But there is that hint that these women were not as other women were. This is strictly in accordance with later Greek conception of the Amazons as a splendid race of women, sternly suppressing natural inclinations in the interests of their community and ideals. The rendering of such sentiments by artists is quite noticeable when we consider these sculptors in comparison with the other examples of the Greek idealization of the female form. Whether it is a simpering Venus, a proud Diana, a majestic Athene, or, to come down to commoner clay, a laughing maiden and dignified matron. Now, if we further contrast this delicate suggestion of a difference founded on a natural deduction from the supposed ideal of the Amazon state with the violent representations of duality of personality as shown in Oriental art, for instance, in the Ardhana Rishvara, we can the more clearly realize the refining influence of the Hellenic spirit. We can but pause in admiration of the sublimity of feeling and wondrous skill with which this is conveyed to the spectator. Yet, story for story, the ethical value of the Oriental is often far superior to that of the Occidental. But in the one case, the spirituality is hidden, the representation of a beautiful thought is gross. In the other, on the contrary, it is sublimed. We may carry the comparison still further by contrasting the story of the Rakshasis inhabited Ceylon, or the island of El Wakwak, which comes to us from India through Arabic sources, with the myth of the island of Aea, where Circe dwelt, surrounded by lovely handmaidens and her tamed wild beasts, bent apparently on much the same work as the Eastern women of inveigling men and then sacrificing them. But how poetically the cruelty underlying the lesson is softened. In the one case, there is crude, vehement symbolism, in the other, much tender humanity. It is partly owing to the latter characteristics that when the Greek artists show men as opponents, there may often be traced an underlying feeling of unwillingness. They are fighting to the death, but without hatred, though, of course, there are exceptions. Such, for instance, as the two equestrian figures shown on a terracotta fragment in the Townley collection, where we see a beardless Greek youth bending forward on his rearing horse to seize with the left hand an Amazon by the hair. Bending her head violently backwards, and as she falls, he lifts his right arm to strike her with a short sword. And there are many fierce combats in the larger relief sculptures. As a rule, however, the artists seem bent on so telling the tale to the world that they may the more clearly impress the lesson they drew from the legends and from the hard struggles of life. The pity of it. The pity of it. In the minor forms of art, the numismatic and fictile branches, we are as a rule a good deal closer in spirit, though by no means always in period of production, to the older versions of the legends. Because, of course, generally speaking, it is more popular art which appealed to the oi polloi. As regards numismatics of Hellenized countries, these tokens on which the apologists have relied so much in making out their case for the historical existence of the state, there is much that is extremely doubtful. A large number of the figures supposed to represent Amazons really being the geniuses of cities. There is, in fact, little to be gathered from them in this connection, either on the historic or the art side. In the pottery, there is often a good deal that is rough, both in modeling and painting, and also in the matter of emotional expression. The crudeness is unquestionably due to its being popular art rather than to its age, for we find in many of the pieces a tendency to complication in design. The Amazons and Greeks do not fight face to face, but twist and turn about in elaborate evolutions, and this is often accompanied by a piling on of detail, thus getting away from the primitive types. But this pottery decoration is almost certainly imitative, if not directly copyistic, too frequently falling to conscious caricature of the noble forms. The legends, in any case, were favorite themes with the potters who frequently show us the Amazons at their favorite trades of killing and maiming. The stories of Bellerophon, Hercules, Hippolyta, and Theseus are portrayed with endless variations, not without considerable vigor. A point to be noted is that in these paintings, the Amazonian queens have the heads of Medusa on their round targets, though sometimes the Gorgon masks are seen on the Greek shields, betraying a certain confusion of ideas, or perhaps the different moral point of view of the artist. While the struggles are generally between the women and Greeks, we occasionally find Amazons assisting the Greeks in their fights against monsters. And the scenes between Achilles and Penthesilea are shown boldly and with some regard to sentiment. There is also a notable variation in the matter of costume, ranging from the short tunic or the chiton to the armor-clad female warriors with their Athenian helmets and crescent-shaped shields, and then to the Persian type of Amazon in close fighting tunics and trousers with Phrygian caps, which is often in startling contrast to the starkness of their adversaries. Apart from the crudeness naturally associated with a large portion of this work, which was mainly mechanical, the designs being stamped on the clay over and over again, we find attempts to show both the fierceness and the physical beauty of the women. When we come to consider the sculptures, even the earliest specimens extant, we must not forget that they belong to an age far removed from the mythmongers, a full 1,000 years later than the legendary days of Amazonian strength and pride. In this branch, almost always the scenes of Amazon combats, be the warriors triumphant in victory or imposing in death, appear to express the Achillean divine sorrow mingled with respect. We can see this even in what remains of the friezes from the Temple of Asclepius, now at the Central Museum. Athens, though these fragments of statuary represent wonderfully lifelike incidents of the fiercest fighting, where the artists have put forth their best efforts to make the spectators enter into the feeling of the veritable frenzy of energy, which seems actually to be enacted before them. An Amazon wounded in the throat slips from the back of her fleeing horse. Another, fallen to her knees, shows a magnificent head in the agony of death, while in the forefront an Amazon very much mutilated is shown astride of a rearing horse, holding her steed by a muscular grip on its panting flanks. She is lifting her right arm, apparently to strike forward with her deadly spear. The head and the greater part of the right arm are missing, but both breasts are indicated under the folds of the draperies. Every figure is instinct with the strenuousness of the battle, displaying the subtleness of the perfectly trained, combined with great beauty of outline. Much care is shown with the drapery. In the sculptures from the Temple of Apollo, the Deliverer, erected at Phygalia in the Peloponnesus, and preserved at the British Museum, there is an equally wonderful gallery of figures of Amazons and Greeks in battle, those of the female warriors having an arresting charm both when exhibiting the vigor of the fighters and the exhaustion of the vanquished. There are in those worn but yet splendid marbles many touching incidents, as well as a good deal of hard fighting. The grouping is spirited, the figures being so arranged as to stand out boldly, giving full value to the moving representations of the hazards, hardships, and rush of battle. A wounded Amazon whose horse has stumbled, thus pitching her forward, has her right foot seized by a Greek intent on completing her downfall. Another mountain Amazon is dragged from her horse by the head. This pulling back of the head by the hair in order to upset the equilibrium or deliver a deadly thrust is shown in three or four other groups, witnessing the intensity of its struggle. On the other hand, the Achillean remorse is given prominence in several places, though on the opposite side. A wounded Greek is supported by an Amazon who has her arm passed behind his shoulders as she leads him away from the strife. Another kneels down to lift a wounded sister, and in a third instance, a woman thrusts forward her arms to ward off the threatening stroke aimed by an Amazon against a fallen foe. It must be said that the chivalry appears to be all on the feminine side, but the point is that there is chivalry shown in a fair fight. The Greek artist has not attempted to belittle or defame the warrior women, whom he regards as foes worthy of Hellenic steel and who are to be respected. This temple was built by Ichthynos, who was associated with Phidias in the designing of the Parthenon, and from what Pliny says, it is clear that leading Athenian sculptors were responsible for its embellishment. So here we have the true Greek feeling. In both these instances, the costumes of the Amazons are quite primitive. The chiton is worn, stopping short well above the knee, caught at the waist by a girdle and carried across the breast to be fastened over the left shoulder. The legs and feet are bare, a strap sometimes being shown over the right ankle to hold the spur. The helmet, when worn, is of the Minerva type. Great skill is displayed in managing the drapery so that it shows off the fine bodily development and the exertion. Simplicity is the characteristic of all the accessories, throwing into greater prominence the physical beauties. The sculptures, now also at the British Museum, from the tomb of Mausolus, satrap of Caria, which his widow erected at Halicarnassus, belong to a somewhat later date and, though inspired by the same feeling, show more license and less refinement in treatment. There is a reminiscence of the older artists. The drapery is longer and ample, the chlamys flowing from the shoulder is added, but in the violence of action the figures are rather apt to be startlingly undraped. There are characteristic touches which take us back to the Scythian wilds. An Amazon fleeing on horseback has vaulted round and, though astride, faces the pursuing enemies, against whom she aims a dart, the Parthian bolt. Here the strife is very pronounced and many of the actions fierce, but it is a fight among equals. The two first groups belong to the supreme age of Greek art, when the influence of Phidias, Polycletus, and Praxiteles was at work. Of the great masters themselves, we have no certain examples, though five celebrated marble statues of Amazons are almost indubitably copies of their original bronzes. All five have a strong family likeness. The Vatican Amazon has been attributed to Phidias, and though in part badly restored, is a thing of priceless beauty. This youthful warrior has been recognized as a special type, differing not so much in general design but in treatment. Unlike the others, she is not supposed to be wounded in her right side. She leans on a lance in the left hand, the right arm, which has been restored, is lifted above the head, the fingers lightly twined about the upper part of the lance. There can be little doubt that the hand should be grasping it, the whole poise of the figure showing that she is preparing to vault onto the back of her horse. The body shows vigor, though in actual repose prior to vaulting. The face is calm and almost sweet in spite of the firmness of the outline. She wears a short chiton, caught up at the waist and fastened over the right shoulder, leaving part of the left thigh and the chest exposed. There is some sign of the Amazon mutilation. Otherwise, it is a model of youthful perfection, though in some respects it might be that of an Adonis. The Capitoline Amazon shows even more tenderness, while true femininity is cleverly avoided. The head, however, is said to belong to another statue, the wounded girl in her short chiton. The right leg, slightly bent back from the knee, must have been represented as leaning on her lance with her right hand, but this has been restored so as to show it uplifted above the head. The left hand drawing the drapery away from her wounded side. There is no sign of the maison mutilation in this statue. The right breast is exposed, but the left is expressed, though covered by drapery. The Berlin wounded Amazon has her right arm lifted above her head as though instinctively raised from a sword thrust in her side. She leans with her left arm on a column. Her left leg is drawn back, contracted by pain. But clear as is the evidence of anguish, there is no contortion of limb or features. The chiton is quite short, and there is little drapery over the upper part of the body. But the folds, which are elaborate, are at once decorative and natural. This statue has been attributed to Polyclitus, but is probably more justly claimed to be a copy of the original bronze, which may, according to the delightful story, have been the one set up in the Temple of Diana at Ephesus. It will be remembered that according to a never-too-probable occurrence reported by Pliny, Phidias, Polyclitus, Trezelas, and Phradmon, all competed for the honor of providing the ex vito Amazon, each being asked to make his vote for the best work. Each placed his own statue first and that of Polyclitus second, virtually a majority verdict for the latter. Though this story of competition has a certain air of reasonableness about it, for according to the very ancient tradition, Ephesus, whether or not originally founded by the Scythian women warriors, had given them refuge when hard-pressed during their retreat after their dash into Attica. All that we can deduct from it is that statues of Amazons were shown in the temple. At all events, this tale of emulation among Greek sculptors to honor Artemis in her more tender moods as the succorer illustrates the humanizing spirit of their art, and would go to explain the undoubtedly striking similarity to the general design of the above three Amazons and those of the Lansdowne and Vienna collections. We are here certainly very far from the dreadful bloodthirsty woman of the primitive legend, or even from the boastful queen of the Iliad. The myth, forged in the dim past when strife was dire and inevitable, had played its part. As outward pressure relaxed and men became more enlightened, the story lost much of its grimness, but had not spent its power. The poet and artist made it their own, drawing from its grim details new meanings, refining its lessons to fit them for a happier stage of civilization. And so they softened the story of Amazonian cruelty to serve their own ends, promoting the cult of the beautiful by holding up the splendid human figures, at once strong and graceful, to the emulation of maid and matron, and by calling for masculine admiration and pity. Chapter 2. The Amazons of Antiquity. Running through the works of early Greek writers, we find a moving and circumstantial story of the rise and fall of a nation of women, who, having been deprived of their husbands, sons, and brothers through the fortunes of battle, and then persecuted by the cruelty of their enemies, took up arms to avenge their wrongs. Thus, having tasted blood, these women, we are told, acquired an unappeasable longing for the lust of carnage, and spurred on by the exaltation of victory, they decided to forswear the rule of man and become their own mistresses. Banishing or mutilating the few males left in their midst, they set about laying the foundations of a state, and either through the necessities of the case or a liking for the calling, adopted arms as a national career. This monstrous experiment succeeding, the boundaries of the state were, if we are to believe various writers, vastly extended, the fame of the women warriors flying swiftly before their advancing legions, carrying terror into distant countries. Occasional war alliances were then formed with neighboring people to enable far-off and hazardous expeditions to be undertaken with greater ease. The women swept west as far as Bohemia, and some say into Gaul, reached the Mediterranean, penetrated India with conquering Dionysius, invaded northern Africa to make treaties with Horus, son of Osiris and Isis, attacked Attica, actually sat down before proud Athens and almost beat her to the dust, founded colonies in Europe and Asia Minor, and built many cities renowned in history. Here, indeed, was a theme to inspire poets with eloquence, to be dwelt upon, embroidered, and otherwise ornamented with diverse fantastic details by chroniclers, to endow the brush of painters, the chisel of sculptors with a fine frenzy, which has left us sometimes quaintly grotesque, but frequently loftily conceived works of art. It is a curious tale, this story of the Amazons, disturbingly elusive when the positive evidence of monuments or other contemporary records are inquired after, a tale full of contradictions and pitfalls for the unwary, yet in its main outline consistent enough. It is impossible to date the story, though many compute it to have commenced between 2500 and 1500 years before our era, and others much earlier, taking into account the far-off expeditions and their merging into the realms of mythology. At all events, in some nebulous period and in an equally cloud-obscured region, the distant lands northeast of the Caucasus barrier, a conspiracy arose among the Scythians against two of their princes named, we are told, Hylanos and Scolopetos, with the result that the milder alternative of banishment was resorted to. The princes and their families, their followers and their families, their partisans and their families, a nation in miniature, were pushed over the borderland and came rushing to the foot and up the slopes of the Caucasus like the swollen yellow flood of an overfull river. Naturally, they slew and stole, settling down to fill places high and places low of the dispossessed. Then, as we might expect, came an uprising of the oppressed when least looked for, but an uprising so successful in its first deceptive appearance that the festering sore caused by the implanted strangers was well nigh wiped off the face of the land. The slaughter of the Scythian men was terrific, and a thoroughness characteristic of those good old times. But the women of the hardy race, inured to hardships by their tribe's recent experiences, retired fighting to the dark mountains. In exile from their own ancestral homes, suddenly deprived of their mankind, and fearing the dire humiliation of subjugation by the vanquishers, in the solitude of their mountain refuge, they came to the desperate resolve to form a women's state. Their first step was to adopt the sacred girdle, that almost universal symbol in the East and Eastern Europe of the unmarried condition. Then, expelling or mutilating the few males left in their midst, they elected two queens, who alternately presided over home affairs while the other organized defense. But from the defensive, the dauntless women soon took the offensive and reconquered their late homes. Such a condition of affairs naturally leading to constant reprisals, the manless state insensibly became organized on a perpetual war footing, an organization which inevitably led to conquests beyond the original borders. Hence a new problem in statecraft. The ravages of time and the sword woefully thinning the population brought urgently under the attention of their rulers the imminence, more or less postponed by possible recruits, of complete extinction. A remedy had to be found. So truces were periodically declared, and those of the younger members of the state who had slain men in battle, discarding their girdles, visited their neighbors and formed temporary unions. Then returning, reassumed the magic circlet. Of the children born of such unions, the males, some report, were sacrificed or, as others say, mutilated and retained as serfs or sent back to their fathers. The girl babes, being fed on mare's milk, on the pith of water reeds, and as speedily as might be on the flesh of game, were brought up rigorously and early made acquainted with hardship, with the use of arms and with horse exercise. They wore a scanty tunic, protected themselves with small shields, and wielded the bow and arrow, the lance and the battle axe. The better to secure the utmost freedom in archery, the right breast was either amputated or atrophied by searing with red-hot irons, or by close binding. And so the Greeks, when they came into contact with them, called them Amazons, or the breastless. With reminiscences of the steppes of their ancestral home, they cultivated horse exercise assiduously and are said to have fought equally well on foot and on horseback. Thus were various precautions taken against the dying out of the race. With a war organization perfected and adopted as the basis of the social economy and a population on the increase, conquest became necessary to the community. Great queens arose who led forth the restless swarms. Marpesia is among the first named of these militant rulers, riding at the head of armies to seize upon adjacent kingdoms, making good their hold on the Caucasus. Climbing the comparatively easy northern slopes, they descended the rugged southern declivities and overran Cappadocia, finally settling on the Thermodon, which empties itself into the Euxine Black Sea, and built thereon their capital of Themyscira, which became the second and greatest cradle of their race. Thence, they pushed their way down to the Aegean Sea, swept over most of Asia Minor into Syria, founding many towns, such as Ephesus and Smyrna. We are told of their ever-restless energy, of their organizing, harassing expeditions, threatening both ancient and rising civilizations, clashing with the armed Trojans in Phrygia, reaching Egypt by way of Syria, and in the train of Dionysus passing through Parthia and so on into India, where, some say, they founded colonies and then, after harassing the Grecian settlements, flaunted Athens itself. Ancient writers mostly speak of the Caucasus as a continuation of the Taurus Range, entirely within Asia, something far away and little known, but others give graphic descriptions of this, the original home of the Amazons. Pliny says that it is of immense extent in separating nations innumerable. After taking its first rise at the Indian Sea, it branches off to the north, on the right-hand side and on left towards the south. Then, taking a direction towards the west, it would cut through the middle of Asia were it not that the sea checks it in its triumphant career along the land. It accordingly strikes off in a northerly direction and, forming an arc, occupies an immense tract of country, nature, designedly, as it were, every now and then throwing seas in the way to oppose its career. Here, the Sea of Phoenicia, there, the Sea of Pontus, in this direction, the Caspian and Hycenian, western and eastern Caspian, and then opposite to them, the Lake Maeotis. Although somewhat curtailed by these obstacles, it still winds along between them and makes its way even amidst these barriers and victorious after all. It then escapes with its sinuous course to the kindred chain of the Riphaean Mountains. Numerous are the names which it bears, as it is continuously designated by new ones throughout the whole of its course. In the first part, it has the name of Imaus, Hindu Kush, after which it is successively known by the names of Imodus, Peropanesus, Circeus, Cambades, Paraedres, Coatras, Origes, Orandes, Nephates, Taurus, and, where it even outtops itself, Caucasus. Where it throws forth its arms as though every now and then it would invade the sea, it bears the name of Sarpedon, Coracesius, Cragus, and then again Taurus. Where it opens and makes passage to admit mankind, it still claims the credit of an unbroken continuity by giving the name of gates to these passes. In addition to this, when it has been cut short in its onward career, it retires to a distance from the seas and covers itself on the one side and the other with the names of numerous nations. So that among the many others, there were the Amazonian and the Scythian chains. He mentions two flaming mountains, probably due to natural gas or naphtha in Syria. Strabo places the Amazons among the most eastern developments of the Caucasus, overhanging the Caspian Sea arid, forming a barrier between the Albanians and Iberians. He also points out that the plains of Scythia and the whole east of Themyscira, named the Plain of the Amazons, are alluvial and offer a strange contrast to their mountain refuges. Pliny, speaking of the geography of this locality in his day, says, upon the coast of the Euxine, there is a river Thermodon which rises at the fortified place called Phanaria, Thermia, and flows past the foot of the Mount Amazonius, Mason Dog. There was formerly a town of the same name as the river and five others in all Amazonium, Themyscira, Cytera, Amasia, and Comana. It will be seen from all this the vastness and uncertainty of the whole great black range which connected the Pontus with the far-off regions hidden in a mysterious chaos of mountains, forests, network of rivers and seas, and dreary plains. All the numerous nations referred to above were equally awe-inspiring. Strabo says, "The Amazons are said to live among the mountains above Albania. Good authors, however, say they live at the foot of the Caucasian mountains. When at home, they are occupied in performing with their own hands the work of plowing, planting, pasturing cattle, and particularly in training horses. The strongest among them spend much of their time in hunting on horseback and practice warlike exercises." In his own day, the people living on the south side of the Caucasus were pirates, who left no peace to their neighbors. Divided into small tribes ruled over by tyrants, they lived by brigandage. Strabo also refers to certain perfectly barbarous tribes of the Caucasus who worshipped the earth, the mother, and offered and ate human sacrifice, though they would neither sacrifice nor eat females of any kind. Clearly, the underlying principle impelling these earth worshippers in this matter was the desire to secure a continuation of species. To this preoccupation, we must attribute the honor they meted out to their aged of being strangled by near kinsfolk. Here, too, the males being eaten while the women were returned to the bosom of the great Mother Earth. The same regard to the bearing principle in nature distinguished the Albanians and Iberians, whom some said were the near neighbors of the Amazons. For these people, though they worshipped chiefly two gods, the sun, Jupiter, probably the unknown god, creator, and the moon, paid special devotion to the latter as being the closer influence. There was a temple to the moon near Iberia, and here the priest of the pale goddess was next in importance to the kin and had governance over extensive and popular tracts of sacred land attached to the shrine. Many of the temple attendants and others were given prophecy. If any one became violently possessed and went about the woods alone, he was seized, bound by the priest in consecrated fetters, and maintained in luxury for a year. Then he was brought forth and placed among the other victims for sacrifice. As the victim stood before the shrine, an attendant of the moon goddess, armed with a sacrificial lance, emerged from the ranks of the encircling crowd, and advancing, struck the sacrifice to the heart. The presiding priest standing by prognosticating from the manner of the fall and the gushing of the blood. After which the body was removed to an appointed place and there trampled upon by the people, so that they might be purified by the gore of the hallowed scapegoat. Herodotus declares that the Tauri sacrificed all shipwrecked persons and all Greeks who happened to be driven to take refuge in their ports, these human offerings being made to a virgin goddess. The victim was struck on the head with a club. The head was then severed and nailed to a tree and the body flung over the rocky cliffs. Prisoners taken in warfare had their heads struck off, which were then placed on tall poles above their houses. Herodotus adds, "The reason that the heads are set up so high is in order that the whole house may be under their protection, which is precisely the same argument used by the headhunters of Borneo and many another savage race." We have earlier hints of this in the ancient Argonautic, attributed to Orpheus, but almost certainly written by Onomacritus of Athens, who flourished 520 to 465 BC. Herein we read much concerning dangerous and ferocious peoples who dwelt round about Lake Maeotis and farther south, among them being the Tauri, a homicidal race who performed direful sacrifices to Artemis, filling the consecrated cup with human blood. Of the Scythian stock, we have terrible tales. They too worshipped the sun and moon and minor gods of the elements, air, fire, water, with sacrificial rites. Scalps of fallen enemies floated as an awful fringe to the bridles of their war horses. That powerful and mysterious race, the Hittites, came from the Caucasus and no doubt originally from the same Scythian stock. They worshipped some nature goddess as Ashtoreth, and their monuments in Asia Minor show that they sacrificed human lives in their religious ceremonies, had guards of priests and priestesses, and observed certain orgies at the vernal season. These Hittites were probably the true founders of Ephesus. They carried the double-headed axe, wore short tunics and high boots with upturned toes. These are snowshoes, which betray their northern origin. And it is curious to find Pliny writing of dwellers in the higher ranges of the Caucasus who wore boots of untanned leather with turned up toes so that they might walk over the snow. This form of boot is often seen worn by the Amazons depicted on pottery and is analogous to the Mongolian shoe still worn in China. Strabo's casual remark as to what the woman did when at home has almost a sarcastic ring about it, for it would appear as though they were very seldom so peacefully occupied, so varied are their movements, so widespread their influence, according to a general chorus of ancient scribes. In fact, 3 centuries of ceaseless warfare and adventure are said to have elapsed between the rise of the Amazons and the period of their greatest activity in Asia Minor, when, we are told, the pressure became so intolerable to the Greeks that Bellerophon, redoubtable descendant of Helios, the sun god, and Poseidon, the sea god, fresh from slaying the Chimera, was sent to the king of Lycia to repel their advance. This task, too, like others of great difficulty, he brought to a successful issue, breaking up the Amazon power for the time being. But events showed that the encroaching power of barbarism had merely been pushed back. Bellerophon gone, the bulwark against the restless tide was removed. Again, the Amazonian threat became insistent. Greece was so hard-pressed that the queens and their doings rose into an ever-shadowing prominence, and one of the 12 labors imposed upon Hercules by Eurystheus, king of the Mycenae, was the extraordinary hazardous duty of capturing the girdle of the Amazon leader, that girdle which was so thoroughly symbolical of Amazonian ideal, and therefore most sacred to them. It was the opening up of great events. Hercules, most of the authors agree, was accompanied on his expedition by Theseus, king of Athens, and the flower of Greek youth, who all embarked on the fleet of splendid galleys. Sailing over the Aegean Sea, they passed through the Bosphorus and Black Sea and reached the mouth of the Thermodon unmolested. They made their way up the river to Themyscira before Antiope, the home-keeping queen, had time to prepare for effective resistance or recall Erythea, her sister and co-queen, who was away on some distant war expedition. With all due ceremony, heralds were dispatched by Hercules to Antiope, demanding the surrender of her girdle, which was tantamount to a demand to capitulation, a request promptly refused. So both parties made ready for battle. The Greeks laid siege and attacked in regular form. On their side, the weakened garrison of Amazons defended their capital with great obstinacy and, under the leadership of the queen, sallied forth to deliver a bloody onslaught. The fighting was fiercest round about Hercules and Theseus. Hercules, invulnerable under his lion's skin, did wondrous deeds, slaying with his own hand 11 Amazon captains, who with undaunted valor came on one after the other to the attack. Diodorus Siculus indeed tells us that Hercules challenged the foremost of the leaders to single combat. Aella, the swift-footed, he slew as she turned and fled. Philippus fell at the first blow, and Prothi, who had killed many men in hand-to-hand fights, was no luckier. Artemis, the huntress, and several others were quickly tripped up and their spirits sent to the shades. Still, Hercules remained untouched. In the end, victory rested with the Greeks, who were by no means slow to reap the reward thereof, as their own writers testify. Many prisoners were made and much booty taken. Hercules, for his part, had captured Menalippe, sister of the 2 queens, while a 4th sister, Hippolyta, fell into the hands of Theseus. Hercules, mindful of his quest, restored his fair captive in exchange for Antiope's girdle. But Theseus, surrendering to his love for fair Hippolyta, took her as his wife and decided to carry her off. There are those, Diodorus among them, who say that Hercules put Menalippe to fight in capturing Antiope, bereft her of her girdle, and then handed her over to Theseus, who bore her away to Athens, where she became the mother of Hippolyte. Apollodorus Athensis adds a touch of the supernatural. According to him, Hippolyta wore the girdle of Mars, which she was willing to give up to Hercules. But Juno, assuming the form of one of the warrior women, appeared in their midst and stirred up the Amazons to resist the Greeks, whom she declared had come to carry off their queen. Nevertheless, the companion of Jove was unable to stay the Grecian success. Hercules, not content with taking possession of the queen's girdle, also carried off her arms, including her formidable double-headed war axe, a symbol of leadership of which we shall hear more later on. The Greeks, thus variously loaded with spoils, re-embarked and set sail for home. When Erythea came hurrying back with her army, it was to find the city in ruins and to listen to the tales of woe uttered by Antiope or Menalippe. Determined to recapture Hippolyta and the other precious spoils, the war queen made an impassioned appeal to her army. What good was it, she asked, for them to be mistresses of Pontus and Asia if, notwithstanding their successes, they remained exposed to the insolence of the Greeks, who dared to flaunt them in the heart of their own state? Were they to submit tamely to murder and rapine? Then, realizing the magnitude of her task, she appealed to Sigilus, king of the Scythians, reminding him that they came of the same stock and were threatened by the same ambitious people. This cry for aid was hearkened to. Sigilus, dispatching his son Penisagoras at the head of a strong body of horse, Erythea herself gathered a great army and, with her allies marching down the Black Sea coast, passed over that narrow part known as the Chimeran Bosphorus on the winter ice. Others say she marched around the Black Sea, crossing the Danube and staying long enough on an island called Ares to build a temple which they dedicated to Mars. The lesson seems to be that peril to Greece from the barbarians lay chiefly through an invasion by way of Thessaly. At all events, most of the authors agree that this daring eruption into Attica came by way of Thessaly. Erythea made a swift march, carrying everything before her, though not without occasional sharp fighting. Arriving before the city of Minerva, which then occupied the site of the Acropolis, she camped her army on the ground renowned as the ancient Athens of Cecrops, and then demanded from Theseus the return of Hippolyta and the sacred girdle. Theseus sent her heralds away empty, and marshaling his army, sacrificed to the god of fear, whose temple was never opened except in times of grave peril. The Athenian king supplicated the god not to trouble the Greeks, but prayed that he should invade the ranks of the enemy and carry dismay to their hearts. The siege was close and lasted for upwards of a month, diversified on the one side by sudden sorties, and on the other by fierce assaults. But little of a decisive nature was accomplished until Theseus prepared to sally forth in force. The Amazonian army presented an extended front, the left wing lying far off on a spot subsequently known as the Amazonium, or the Plain of the Amazons, the center occupying the Areopagus, and the right resting on the Nyx. The Athenians delivered the attack from the museum, but were turned by the Amazons and driven back to the Temple of Eumenides. Greek reinforcements hurried up from the Palladium, Ardithus, and Lyceum. Then a stubborn hand-to-hand fight took place, the women being so hard-pressed that they were at last compelled to seek refuge in their camp. That this feat was only accomplished by putting forth the most strenuous efforts is a point insisted upon by chroniclers. All traditions lay stress on the deadly character of the conflict, and these helped to produce the deep-seated impression so vividly brought home to us when we study the spirited sculptures in which these combats are portrayed. The carnage was terrible and seemed to be never-ending. Both sides fought desperately for hearth and home until Hippolyta made her appearance to act as mediatrix between the troops of her victorious but almost exhausted husband and the defeated, though by no means routed, army of her sister. Ultimately, peace was sworn and the Horkamozin or Oath House erected as a memento of the ceremony. Then the slain having received honorable burial, the remnant of the army, having been in Attica some 4 months, was led back through Greece under a truce. We are told that Hippolyta died and was buried at Megara, where her tomb was long to be seen, while other tombs of Amazons were shown in Athens, in Boeotia, and in Thessaly. But of these and of the Temple of the Amazons at Athens, no traces have been discovered in modern times. Certain historians, Plutarch being among the number, hold that Theseus did not accompany Hercules to Thermodon, that expedition being supposed to have kept the Amazons quiet for a long time. But it is said that Theseus, at a later date, either invaded the Amazon state in force or went there by stealth and by stratagem possessed himself of Queen Antiope, by whom he had Hippolyta. These authors hint that the Amazon eruption into Attica was due to other reasons than the recapture of a girl, and agree that the incursion was a most serious affair. According to these accounts, Antiope, when she rushed forward to shield her husband, was killed by an arrow shot by Malpadia, who in her turn was slain by Theseus. Otherwise, the incidents of the siege are told much in the same way, though some say that it was the Amazons who were driven back to the Temple of the Furies. If we accept the general version, Orithya's army beaten, though not without honor, for they were retreating with their arms and under the safeguard of a sworn peace, and having erected images in several temples as thanks offerings, were nevertheless ashamed to go back to Themyscira with the mission unfulfilled. Passing with the male Scythian allies once more through Thessaly, they reached Scythian settlements in Thrace, where a new Amazon state was founded, which later on sent offshoots farther west. Apparently, these settlements were formed under laxer laws, for the organization gradually broke up and, merging into the surrounding population, this branch of the warrior women returned to a natural mode of life. Pausanias, in his description of Megara, states that in his day near the shrine of Pandion in that city there was the tomb of Hippolyta, and he repeats the Megarian account of the events leading up to her death. When the Amazons reached against the Athenians on account of Antiope and were vanquished by Theseus, most of them died fighting. But Hippolyta, who was sister to Antiope and at that time held the command of the women, escaped with a few others to Megara. There, however, the disaster which had overtaken her army filled her with despondency at the situation in which she found herself, and with despair of ever returning safe home to Themyscira. She died of grief, and they buried her. Her tomb is shaped like an Amazon shield, or according to some renderings, is adorned with an Amazonian shield. There was much controversy as to the alleged founding of towns by the Amazons during their incursions into Asia Minor and other quarters. As regards Ephesus, Pausanias corrects Pindar, who attributes the erection of the sanctuary to them. He argues that it is true that the women from Thermodon, knowing the sanctuary of old, sacrificed to the Ephesian goddess both this occasion, when hurrying away from Athens, and when they fled from Hercules, and some of them had sacrificed there at a still remoter time when they fled from Dionysius and sought the protection of the sanctuary. But it was not by them that the sanctuary was founded. This invaluable Murray or Baedeker of the ancient world had much to say that is worth noting, for many of the great public and sacred buildings at Athens, Olympia, and other places were adorned with paintings or sculpture, often by most renowned artists, showing the different events in this momentous war. And Pausanias gives descriptions, though often tantalizingly succinct, of most of these. We cannot do better than follow this guide, who relates that he actually saw and the tales that were current. At Athens itself, there was prominently enough the fine paintings on the walls of the market colonnade, representing Theseus and his fellow Athenians fighting the Amazons, who were mostly shown on horseback. Pausanias comments, "It would appear that their intrepidity was not abated by reverses." For great events awaited the Amazons after Theseus had done with them and had departed to the shades. These paintings were of the famous Mycon, who flourished 460 BC, and were to be seen down to the middle of the 4th century of our era. Beside the gymnasium, says our Cicerone, is a sanctuary to Theseus, with paintings of the Athenians fighting the Amazons. But the great attraction in this matter was on the south wall of the Acropolis, where there were figures 2 cubits high dedicated to Attalus. They represented the legendary war of the giants who once dwelt about Thrace and the Isthmus of Pallone, the fight of the Athenians with the Amazons, the battle with the Medes at Marathon, the destruction of the Gauls at Mysia. It has been conjectured that this Attalus was the second of that name, and moreover, that these figures, which appear to have been of lightweight bronze, for Plutarch speaks of one of them having been blown over by wind, were reductions from larger sculptures erected to Attalus I. In Asia Minor, replicas in marble of these have been traced to the museums of the Louvre, Aix, Venice, and Naples, in which last-named place there are recumbent figures of a dead Gaul and an Amazon, who is shown lying on her back, the right leg bent at the knee and partly drawn up. At Olympia, we are told most of the deeds of Hercules were shown, and among others, his wrestling the girdle from the Amazon queen. This was repeated in a sculptured group not far from the offerings of the Achaeans, where Hercules was shown fighting the queen, who was on horseback. This group was due to the chisel of Aristocle, the Sinodian, whom Pausanias reckons as among the most ancient of the sculptors. In his graphic description of Olympian Zeus, whose statue and throne were adorned with gold, ebony, ivory, and precious stones, he says there was much sculpture and painting. Between the feet of the immense throne were three bars bearing images. On one of these bars is the troop that fought on the side of Hercules against the Amazons. The total number of figures is 29. Theseus is arrayed among the allies of Hercules. Barrier-like walls kept the populace from passing under the throne, and on three sides of these walls were paintings, the fourth side being blue, like the sky. The last paintings are Penthesilea, giving up the ghost, and Achilles supporting her. Then, on the footstool with its golden lions, was the Battle of Theseus wrought in relief on it. This battle was the first deed of valor done by the Athenians against a foreign foe. Next, he tells us that at Pyrrhicus were two temples, one to Artemis, the putter of an end to the war, because here the Amazons were stopped from further warfare, and the other to Apollo Amazonius. Both have wooden images, and tradition says they were votive offerings of the women that came out from Thermodon. Their name crops up again and again in this painstaking itinerary, all of which unmistakably testifies to the importance attributed to these events by the Athenians. To them, they were not only memorable wars, but worthy of being commemorated as among the most glorious of their actions. Herodotus, too, makes the Athenians boast of this in their angry war of words with the Tegeans, as to which of them should have the honor of occupying the left flank when facing the Persian army. The sons of Athene exclaim, "Another noble deed of ours was that against the Amazons when they came from their seat upon the Thermodon and poured their hosts into Attica." This sentiment of pride in their stand against the fighting women is repeated over and over again. It is indeed a sentiment felt in common by the sober chronicler, the poet, and the artist. Another subject for wonder and admiration on the part of the Greeks is the stubbornness of the Amazons, who, surviving the crushing expeditions of Bellerophon and Hercules, their defeat by Theseus, yet remained as a formidable fighting organization able to attack near and far kingdoms, and even to venture once more to measure their strength with the Greeks when they met before the walls of Troy. No wonder that Pausanias records with some astonishment, "Their intrepidity was not abated by reverses." We hear of an attack on the Phrygians, who implored assistance from their neighbors, and among others Priam, king of Troy. Long after that war, Priam, when viewing the Greek army from the walls of his doomed capital, told Helen,
"In Phrygia once were gallant armies known, in ancient times when Otreus filled the throne, when godlike Mygdon led the troops of horse, and I, to join them, raised the Trojan force. Against the man-like Amazons we stood, and Sangar's stream ran purple with their blood."
In spite of this spilling of blood, however, it would seem that the victory remained with the Amazons, for though we are told of the death of their queen Marina during the campaign, their influence on Persia is one of the points insisted upon by ancient historians, and is supposed to have subsisted down to the days of Alexander of Macedon. Strabo tells us that in the Ilian plain, there was a hill dedicated to Myrina, the Bounding, so called because this enterprising queen was a great horsewoman, who is supposed to have been buried here beneath a great cairn. It was through Phrygia that they invaded Syria and passed into Egypt, though if we are to accept the legend of their forcing an alliance upon Horus, this must be credited to an earlier expedition, or chronology would be put hopelessly out of joint. Some years after the exploit of Priam on Sanger's gory banks, the Amazons were in alliance with the Trojans against the Greeks. But whether this was due to their admiration of the father-in-law of Helen, or to their undying hatred of the countrymen of Bellerophon, Hercules and Theseus, it is hard to say. At all events, at the call of Priam, Penthesilea arrived before Troy with a small band of Amazons, while the venerable king was celebrating the funeral rites of Hector, but recently slain by Achilles. The queen was received with great joy by Priam, who was as much struck by her beauty as by her courage. But Andromache warned this self-confident warrior that she would not find Achilles, who had killed her own lord and many another valiant captain, an easy foe to conquer. Undaunted by prophecies of evil, Penthesilea, clothed in light armor and wearing a helmet, armed with a sword, bow, and arrows, the formidable double-headed axe in her right hand, a couple of lances, and a shield in her left, mounted her charger and went forth to battle at the head of her 12 warriors. As the Amazons advanced, the Greeks stood still, astonished at what they beheld and somewhat fearful. Penthesilea, throwing a dart by way of signal, dashed to the fray, and with her terrible axe killed 8 of the leading Greek captains. But several of the notable Amazons also fell, and the queen redoubled her furious attack, urging her followers and allies to the slaughter. The fight was at its height and the Greeks wavering when the din of battle reached the ears of Achilles and Ajax, who were offering sacrifice to the manes of Patroclus. Arming themselves, they hastened to the very thick of the melee and endeavoring to stay the advancing tide of Trojan forces. Then the Greek heroes came face to face with the Amazons. Penthesilea, turning to the new arrivals and recognizing them as the most doughty leaders, threw a dart at Achilles, who parried it with his famous shield. Turning her anger against Ajax, the queen again saw her effort frustrated. As the two contending armies paused to watch this heroic duel, Penthesilea advanced and, claiming to be a daughter of Mars, told the Greeks that they were always aggressors, and though their armor had turned aside her avenging darts, they would not be able to escape the wrath she was about to visit upon them with the aid of her axe, which would thus bring relief to groaning Troy. Achilles, on his part, chiding the queen for her vainglorious speech and her unpardonable temerity, told her not to imagine herself invincible, for if she was the daughter of Mars, the Greeks were sons of Jupiter, the lawgiver to gods and men. Hector had fallen to his lance, and she could only hope for a like fate, as the sons of Jupiter were more powerful than the daughters of Mars. So saying, Achilles threw a dart, which pierced her right breast, covering the queen with blood. Then the mighty Greek captain thrust at her horse, and as it fell, he vaulted from his own charger, and with his lance ran his prostrate foe through the body. Withdrawing his weapon, he bent over to despoil her of her armor, and he thus stooped over her. Achilles was overcome by the glorious beauty of the dying queen, and reflecting on her courage, he praised Penthesilea, gently in his arms and gazing on her calm face, blamed himself for having dealt the fatal blow to so peerless a creature. The Grecian army stood by in respectful silence. Only Thersites ventured to raise his voice to reproach his leader for these softer feelings. Achilles, not deigning to use his weapons against such a creature, struck him in the face with his open hand, hurling him to the ground, a dead man. Then, once more raising the lifeless body of the Amazon's queen, he gave it into the honorable keeping of the Trojans. It is one of the incidents that most deeply impressed itself upon Hellenic thought and its expression in art. It formed the central motive of the Ethiopia of Arctinus of Miletus, long supposed to be a precursor of the Homer cycle, but who really flourished about 770 BC, and whose great poem was a continuation of the Iliad. Indeed, it was occupied with describing the combats between the Greeks and the Amazons and the final acts of Achilles. Tradition says that its finest passages related to the great duel between the Amazon queen and the Greek leader. The latter's anger followed swiftly by sentiments of respect and pity as he contemplated the beautiful woman who he had slain. The Ethiopia has only come down to us in insignificant fragments, though its influence is seen prominently both in literature and art, where it represents the later feelings of the Grecians when they had grown out of the terrors that had inspired the growth of the myth. Quintus Smyronius probably gives the best rendering of this last legend, though he adds certain marvels. According to him, Penthesilea is moved not so much by hatred against the Greeks as from a personal grief, she having accidentally killed her sister while out hunting. So,
her crime to expiate with her sword, to offer victims to the Furies dire, who thou unseen pursued her to avenge her sister's blood. For with unwearied speed they chased the guilty, tracking all their steps.
Spurred on by this terrible need for atoning by offering human victims to the ghost of the dead and to the outraged deities, Penthesilea goes forth with her 12 companions and is welcomed by Priam on the fatal morn.
When Aurora, rosy-ankled, smiled, Penthesilea left her couch and clothed her limbs in armor sheen, the gift of Mars. First to her snowy legs she fitted clothes, the golden greaves, and on her tender breast bound the strong plate of variegated mail. Then from her shoulder the huge sword she slung, proudly its sheath all exquisitely wrought with ivory and silver. Next she took her crescent buckler, like the horned moon, when gleaming over the waves, she climbs the sky with half-replenished lamp. Her helmet last, its nodding crest beroped with gold, she placed upon her head. In this array she shone refulgent, as the forky fires that Jove hurls to earth, the red vaunt couriers of the big raindrops and the roaring winds. In her left hand, behind the shield she bore, two javelins snatched in haste, and in her right an axe with double edge, which discord gave to the maiden's great defense in war.
Then she hurries to the fray, carrying slaughter among the Greeks, and at last espying Achilles and Ajax, she flies to meet them, and after the inevitable war of words, she is slain by Achilles, who, stooping to remove her armor,
felt exceeding grief, as on the body of the maid he gazed, mourning her not less than for the death of his beloved Patroclus.
Quintus adds that Mars rushed down from Olympus, alighting on Mount Ida, which rocked and streamed with fire, and the war god would have attacked the Greeks had he not been restrained by the thunder and lightning of angered Jove. In all this, we see the Greek feeling as to the inevitableness of tragedy. Mere mortals are driven by fate, the sport of the gods. While struggling with this sentiment, there peeps out the old cruel doctrine that outraged gods can be appeased alone by personal or vicarious sacrifice of life. And so the scene closes on a note of pity. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.